United States v. Billups. Mr. Anderson.
This may please the court. I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Brian Billups. Mr. Billups pled guilty to possession of cocaine with intent to deliver, and he was then sentenced as a career offender based on two prior convictions, one of which was the Wisconsin offense of false imprisonment. However, there was nothing in the record which the district court could consider under Shepard, which showed that that was actually a crime of violence. In Wisconsin, whoever intentionally confines or restrains another without the person's consent commits false imprisonment. The state goes on to define without consent in a manner which can include actual but unknowing consent due to mistake of fact or law or ignorance or perhaps even legal incapacity to consent due to youth or a mental problem. So the offense doesn't have the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another as a required element, which makes it similar to the Indiana offense of criminal confinement, which this court in Hagenow found was not facially a crime of violence. In Gilbert, this court later found that the Indiana offense can be committed by fraud or enticement, just as the Wisconsin offense can be, since it can be committed, plus misrepresentation of legal authority even. Now, in contrast, this court has held that the Illinois offense of unlawful confinement or restraint is a crime of violence because of the potential for violence when someone's restrained against his will. Albert Hagenow noted that in Indiana, one can confine a person without consent in a manner that, although unpleasant, doesn't present a serious potential risk of physical injury to the person. And that's also true in Wisconsin, where the consent can be present, but due to ignorance or mistake, or, for example, two people can go into a room together, one says, wait a minute, I'll be right back, walks out, locks the door behind him, and walks off. Well, that's false imprisonment, but there wouldn't seem to be much potential for physical injury there. Even the person finds out they're locked in, unless they think they can bust the door down, there's not much they can do, except wait for somebody to let them out. If Hagenow and Wallace are inconsistent, if this court makes that finding, then this court should follow the more recent and more limited decision in Hagenow rather than continuing to expand the list of crimes of violence, as this court has previously expressed concern with.
Well, the charge could cover either one, I guess, couldn't it? Of the false imprisonment. He could have...
Yeah, he could have committed it in any way.
It comes down to how do you get in what happened here? And I think where he hit her, and whether or not that should have been part of the analysis. Right?
Right. And once you get to that point, there wasn't anything that the district court had before it that it was allowed to consider. The complaint was recited in the pre-sentence report, but that's not a final charging document in Wisconsin. Therefore, the district court shouldn't have been considering that, as the court found in Shannon. It didn't have the information before it, so even if that had been helpful, there was no basis for it to conclude on, looking at the information that it was a crime of violence. No.
But Mr. Anderson, at the sentencing hearing, didn't counsel for Mr. Billups concede that the battery conviction, which is a misdemeanor, does not qualify, but that came out of the same, arose out of the same acts as the false imprisonment? At page 5 of the transcript of the sentencing hearing?
Well, it would have been nice if it stated a little clearer, but if you go on to the next page, it looks to me like he's saying, well, that's what the pre-sentence report says. Don't think you should consider that because this not something you can consider under Shepard, but even if you can, well, I've got to argue that it's still not a crime of violence, and so it looks like he was arguing in the alternative, saying, yes, this is what the pre-sentence report says, you shouldn't consider it, but even if you consider it, it still doesn't qualify.
If the defendant assents to certain facts or agrees that certain things are the fact, that could be considered under Shepard, couldn't it?
It probably could be. I don't think he was clearly saying more than that, yes, that's what the complaint says. I don't think he was clearly saying that the complaint was accurate. Simply conceding that that's what it said, and the probation officer got it right to that extent, although it could be clearer. And Now, on appeal, the government introduced the information into the record. But even if that's now properly part of the record, it really doesn't help much. It just cites the statute, date, and victim of the offense. Doesn't say exactly what Mr. what manner in which Mr. Phillips is charged with committing the offense, so that we know what type of false imprisonment this was. You know, it does show the other misdemeanor battery conviction, which was on the same day and the same victim, but it doesn't necessarily state that those were part of the same course of conduct. For all we know, one happened in the morning and one happened in the evening, and were otherwise entirely unrelated. At least from looking at the information, we can't tell any different. Therefore, even if it's now properly part of the record, it's not sufficient to show that Mr. Phillips' crime was a crime of violence. And
I guess I'm having a little difficulty with that, because Mr. Nichols, the defense lawyer's statement, is based on the letter that he wrote, I guess, to the probation office in raising an objection to the pre-sentence report, and he notes in that letter that he was found guilty, that Phillips was found guilty of a battery charge at the same time he was found guilty of the false imprisonment arising out of all the same acts.
He so does, and then he seemed to back.
I don't see how you get from there to saying perhaps the false imprisonment was in the morning and the battery could have been later in the day or something like that. I don't see how you get there.
If he had maintained that at sentencing, perhaps it would be an instrumental problem, but he backed off from that at sentencing. Where, for example, in that letter, he also conceded that it would be a crime of violence, where at sentencing he said, no, it's not a crime of violence, and the court was clearly ruling on that. The court didn't say, wait a minute, you've already waived this. You can't change your mind now. And so effectively that's what he was doing, and so we're relying on the later statements at sentencing rather than the somewhat inconsistent statements he made earlier in his letter to the probation officer.
Well, the judge has to operate on the information before her, and there is one person in the room who knows what happened. That's the defendant. He didn't point out anything to contradict the statement of his client, of his counsel there.
That's true. But the judge also had before her the statements of counsel at sentencing, and the judge didn't rely on these allegedly being part of the same acts. Once she found out that the battery wasn't a felony, she went on from there and just said that, well, because it's false imprisonment, there's a potential for violence anytime somebody is restrained against their will, and therefore that's enough. And the problem is that wasn't enough. Therefore, this court should reverse Mr. Phillips' sentence and remand his case for resentencing without the career offender provision of the guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. The district court correctly found that Mr. Phillips' unlawful restraint of Ms. Schody was a crime of violence for two categories of reasons. First, there's no dispute that it wasn't confinement or restraint. The defendant was convicted of unlawful restraint, that the information is paraphrased in the pre-sentence report addendum. So that information was before the court. But the offense in and of itself does present a real risk of injury to others. And the district court correctly found that involuntary restraint carries with it an inherent risk of serious potential injury.
Did she confine her decision to that? She didn't worry about the fact that he hit her, or didn't. That was not part of the analysis. Yeah. Saying that just this kind of confinement, kind of like other crimes, like burglary and things, there's a potential for violence or injury or whatever. That's why I'm wondering if that's, as he says, that's what it was confined to, as opposed to somehow through the attorney or somewhere else getting in this issue that he hit. You understand what I mean?
Right. In that, yeah, I think I do. I hope I do. I don't.
Because she did say this, that it's just basically it's inherently.
Yeah, she said this is inherently dangerous.
Without evidence of a hit.
I get it. Mr. Nichols clearly said, hey, there was a battery here too. And that's at the page 13 of the supplemental appendix. Now, how that factored in with the court's analysis, the court didn't run that all the way down to the ground, but I respectfully submit that Mr. Anderson's perspective, his reading of the transcript is strained. Mr. Nichols clearly said in line 6, Mr. Billups was found guilty of a battery charge at the same time he was found guilty of the false imprisonment arising out of all the same acts. So in this court can be certain that there was violence involved in this too. But I really think part of this, and Mr. Billups suggests, you know, now on appeal, he didn't suggest it before, that maybe Ms. Schody, the victim, maybe her lack of consent was because Mr. Billups was pretending to act under lawful authority, or maybe Ms. Schody, the victim, is somehow mentally infirm. Now, the possibility of a hypothetical scenario is not the benchmark that this court measures a crime against. I mean, practical experience and common sense indicates that nationwide, hundreds, if not thousands, of drunk drivers get home safe and sound without having hit anybody else. But that's a crime of violence, right? And common sense also indicates that every day people meekly turn themselves into jail after having walked away from work release or are arrested without incident when they have failed to go to jail as directed by a court. We call those crimes of violence. I think the district court quite reasonably found that involuntary restraint was something that does have a high probability of violence. And it sort of gets down.
How do you reconcile that Wisconsin statute with the Indiana statute that's analyzed in the Hagenau case? The consent provisions that can include deceit or trickery.
It can include. And I think, from my perspective, Your Honor, it comes down to the difference between confinement and restraint, in my view. Which, in my view, is backed up by the American Heritage Dictionary on the 16th floor of this building. And it's totally open to that page today, those definitions now, or at least restraint. The way the word restraint is used is different than confinement, and in the way it's defined is different. In defense counsel, in his reply, cited Blacks. But I think the way these terms are used every day is very, very different. An umpire restrains a hit batter from charging the mound, correct? A sick child is confined to his bed, on the other hand. And implicit in the word restraint is that somebody's will has been overborne, that they are being held back. I respectfully encourage defense counsel or the court or anybody else to try to come up with a sentence that does not sound awkward, where restraint means sort of a passive confinement. I tried last night, and I tried again this morning. I could not come up with one. A prisoner confined to a cell is just sitting there doing their time. However, a prisoner restrained to their cell, there's a in their cell that brings up a mental image of a person who is combative, who is resisting, who does not want to be in there. And I think that is what this court tried to get at in Gilbert and in Wallace. And in Gilbert, the court found that one could confine another without serious risk of potential injury, with the example that he gives, you know, lock somebody in the room. Or if they're mentally infirm, say, hey, listen, you know, God wants you to stay here, so stay in the room. You don't even have to lock it if they're mentally infirm, perhaps.
Well, it sounds like you're saying restrained is sort of a hands-on thing, and confined is after the fact.
And the American Heritage Dictionary backs me up. It is a more active verb than confinement, in my view. And in this court, in Gilbert and in Wallace, Pretty much said the same thing. And, of course, in the last point, and we're not going to replow this ground, you know, the defense attorney told the court that this offense involved battery, bodily injury to another. And that is also borne out in the information that the defendant pled to, and that, you know, and it's perfectly appropriate for the court to consider an information to which a person pled guilty under Shepard. So that's the sum of my argument. I appreciate the court's questions. If there are any other, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll respectfully request that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Mr. Anderson?
Yes. First, the I don't frankly see where the information is paraphrased in the addendum, but I'm not sure that makes much difference. And the words confinement and restraint are synonyms, as I pointed out, at least in Black's Law Dictionary. Area, the confinement's an act of imprisoning or restraining someone. Restraint is confinement, abridgment, or limitation. So the difference in word choice didn't seem to resolve the question. It may not be the typical way somebody would say it, but if some were to say that he restrained someone in his room by locking the door, that would be correct.
Are you confined here or restrained, Mr. Chairman?
Well, that would be up to the court, whether I'm either one. As far as the discussion at sentencing, the court first said that, it didn't think it was supposed to consider the particular circumstances of Mr. Billups' arrest. It thought that was what defense counsel was arguing. And Mr. Nichols then said he thought, yes, that was correct, but he was taking that on the basis which the PSR writer was saying it was a crime of violence, not simply the elements of the charge, and that the court wasn't supposed to look at that, but he felt like he had to address it because it was in the PSR. So, certainly it doesn't seem clear that he's saying these facts are accurate, just, well, that's what it says, and I don't have anything to contradict that. I've got to say something. The court then said it was a close question, but ultimately says that it seems to me, however, that any time you have one person exercising power over another person, whether it's by physical force, words, threats, that there is an inherent risk of serious potential injury. The person who's restrained may not want to be restrained and may react by causing injury, etc. The court wasn't relying on the facts of the case there. It's clear that she was relying simply on the elements of the offense in order to determine that it was a crime of violence. Therefore, this court should reverse. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fifth.